And I started a blog.
Y abrir un blog.
Life in Cuba with activist Yoani Sanchez. That's this week on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to begin today's program by recognizing a critical moment in the history of civil rights. We're talking about the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. 50 years ago today, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act to outlaw discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. During the signing ceremony, the president called it a way for America to honor its promise of liberty.
This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
Today, we wanted to reflect on the legacy of the act with two historians who've been deeply immersed in the history of the movement and also lived through the changes sparked by the law. Charles Cobb is the author most recently of This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. Also joining us is Taylor Branch. His latest book is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
So, Charles Cobb, let me start with you. You were involved in the civil rights movement. You served as a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Mississippi. Does the day the act was signed register with you? Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah. I remember it rather vividly. We were not particularly surprised at this point that a civil rights act had been signed into law. After all, it had been churning through the Congress. Although we were pleased with the opening up of public facilities that the act mandated, we were disappointed that it didn't tackle the question of protection for people involved in the movement, federal protection or local communities under attack.
Hmm. Taylor Branch, what was the single most important factor in getting the Civil Rights Act passed at that time?
The Republican Party. I think it's hard for people in today's politics to look back and realize that over 80% of Republicans in both the House and the Senate voted for this bill on final passage, including on July 2nd, in an era when the party of Lincoln meant that the party of Lincoln led on race, and yet you had a Democratic president at a time when most Democrats and all Southern Democrats had their party identity grounded in segregation. So it's a pretty big change foreign to a lot of people who didn't live through this era that the race issue was strong enough to turn our partisan national structure of politics upside down from a time when all segregationists were Democrats to now.
Charles Cobb, though, talk a little bit more about that, if you will. You know, from you were saying that one of the things you were disappointed by was that there was no protection for the people working in the movement. There was no federal protection for it. Talk a little bit about why you felt that was so necessary. What were some of the conditions that you were seeing that you felt that was so necessary?
Murder, for one. Violence in the sense of church bombings. The Birmingham church bombings come to mind, or bombings and attacks against homes, individuals associated with the movement, as well as staff people. And you have to understand the whole Southern police system, you know, was, and I say almost without exception, the whole entire Southern police system, sheriffs, police chiefs, state police, were committed to segregation and often allied with the perpetrators of violence in the Ku Klux Klan, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. For instance, the Ku Klux Klan headquarters was across the street from City Hall. We saw no prospect of gaining protection from local authority. Therefore, we were very concerned about getting federal protection. The position of the federal government at that time was that they could not provide such protection. That involves a politics that's probably too lengthy and too complicated to talk about here.
Taylor Branch, you were talking about the fact that there was a political consensus around this act that a lot of people today would find surprising. What about public opinion? Where was public opinion about it?
Public opinion was innocent and somewhat shocked. I mean, most people favored the Civil Rights Act of 64. At the same time, a lot of white people thought the civil rights movement was going too far, too fast, that it had dominated the conversation for too long. People wanted to get past race. But it was a very, very unusual period in the sense that because the civil rights movement for 10 years since the Brown decision had tenaciously lifted racial injustice into public view, there was a brief period in our history where everybody was talking about race. I mean, the Bridge columnist Oswald Jacoby announced publicly that he had never even noticed the race of people that he was playing bridge with. Food columnists were writing about it. In the filibuster in the Congress, Senator Robert Byrd, in the longest speech in the history of the United States Senate, before the Senate invoked cloture, trying to resist it and preserve segregation, went through every parable of Jesus and showed how every parable from the Bible was compatible with segregation. Even, you know, love your neighbor. He said the Bible says you should love your neighbor, but it doesn't say you can't choose who your neighbor is and build a fence between you and your neighbor. So this was a rare moment in American history when the civil rights movement and people like Charlie Cobb and the people down in Mississippi had forced America to confront the fact that race had always been at the heart of whether or not we were living up to the promise of equal citizenship, what we the people means. It was true that day. I mean, 50 years ago this morning, the chairman of the House Rules Committee said, "We are about to vote on this monstrous instrument of oppression upon all of the American people." That was the way it was described at the time. In other words, the choice was for the people who defended segregation. They said that to end it would enslave white people, basically that you, because they would be forced. They said in the Senate, a hairdresser might be forced to cut the hair of a woman of an opposite race, of a different race, and this was about as the worst thing people could imagine. It's hard to look back on this period now and realize how exposed people were at the time when they were trying to discuss race when it came to the surface in American politics.
If you're just joining our conversation, we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Our guests are historians Taylor Branch and Charles Cobb. Charles Cobb?
I think it's worth mentioning that there was a changed tone at the federal level that really affected a changed attitude among the general population. One was Birmingham in 1963, particularly the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church and the police dogs used against protesters. And the other was the June 1964 murder of the three civil rights workers in Mississippi, James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman. It kind of, sadly, I have to say, because it involved death, forced the federal government to change Kennedy's speech after the police riot, which is how I think of it, in Birmingham, had a great deal of impact, I think, and represented a shift in tone, certainly of the Kennedy administration, which was cool and aloof toward the Southern freedom movement, and certainly the 1964 murders in Mississippi. And I think that had a great deal to do with the enactment of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
So let's bring it forward then, you know, Charles Cobb. You talked about the ambivalence that you and other activists felt on the signing that day. You were happy about, obviously, the expected improvements in the quality of life and also disappointed that things were missing. Let's just cast it forward and just give me a final thought, if you would, about what you think the legacy of the act is or was or has been, or what you would want us to think about when we think about the Civil Rights Act.
Well, I think the legacy, the important legacy of the act, aside from, you know, just outlawing discrimination in public, is often overlooked, and that is this act expanded the rights of all people in the United States. It banned discrimination against women ban discrimination on the basis of religion. What you see, if you really look at this act, is the connection of civil rights struggle in the South to a better life and more opportunities for all Americans.
Taylor Branch, final thought from you as well?
My final thought is that what this shows us 50 years later is that we're unaware of the fact that racial latent and subliminal racial division underlies partisan gridlock today, because a lot of people don't really want to see just what Charlie was talking about how when we dealt with discrimination by race, it opened doors to new freedoms that are valued by women to go to schools, to be in jobs and professions, by the disabled, by seniors, by gay and lesbian people, countless. It opened the door to equal citizenship. And unless we're willing to talk about race, we can't acknowledge that hopeful future and that hopeful capacity to deal with our problems now. So we're stuck in gridlock in part because we don't want to discuss the fact that race opened these doors.
Historian Taylor Branch is the author most recently of The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. He was kind enough to join us from member station WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland. Charles Cobb is the author most recently of This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. And if you're interested in my conversation with him about that book, please just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and go to Tell Me More. He joined us from member station WJCT, which is in Jacksonville, Florida. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, the U.S. soccer team may be out of the World Cup tournament after a loss against Belgium yesterday, but Team USA fans are still singing the praises of the team, especially U.S. goalie Tim Howard. We'll talk about the game and other entertainment news of the week in our Pop Culture Salon. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the Supreme Court term that just ended with Adam Liptak, the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. We'll review major decisions and discuss what they reveal about the nine justices. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Carol Hills. What do you do when your country becomes the butt of jokes? You elect a comedian as mayor of your capital, of course, even if the political establishment is livid.
That I am incapable of doing my job, I'm not qualified, and that I'm a clown.
Mayor of Reykjavik, Iceland, next time on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Right about now, we often head into our beauty shop roundtable where we talk about issues of the day with a panel of women commentators. On Friday, of course, we have the barbershop guys. Today, though, we decided to mix things up a bit and dig into some pop culture stories. And for that, we have our salon, and we have a panel of men and women. So sitting in the chairs for a fresh cut or a new do, as the case may be, are Sarah Ventry. She's a senior producer with a public radio station, KJZZ, in Arizona. Joseph Cummings is a journalist and the creator of the blog Until I Get Married. Bridget Armstrong is a Tell Me More producer. She's also the creator of the blog BigAPicture.com. And Michael Arsenault is a writer and contributor to Complex and Ebony.com. Welcome to everybody. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Well, you know, I do want to start talking about Tim Howard, the goalkeeper for the USA team, who made 16 saves against Belgium yesterday. It was a World Cup record, not enough to keep Team USA alive in the tournament, so they're heading home. But people are calling him an American hero. He's the latest hot meme on the web. Bridget, I happened to notice you watching the game, and I wondered whether that was because you wanted to or because I put it on the production calendar and turned all the TVs into the office to the game. I just wondered which that was.
It was definitely against my will. I don't really watch sports at all, so I'm not discriminating just against the World Cup. But it was exciting to see. I mean, I couldn't help but to be excited with everyone yelling at the screen while I was trying to work. But it was exciting, even though
duly noted on your time card.
Right.
Worked slow because was made to.
We had a chance. When we had a chance at winning, I must admit, I got into it. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to be watching any more of these games, but, you know, the jury's still out.
Did anybody else have World Cup fever? Was it really just me?
Oh, I definitely had World Cup fever.
Okay.
I don't, and it's definitely temporary because I don't follow soccer. I don't really watch soccer, but I felt like it was my patriotic duty to get involved with the World Cup.
Right.
And root for the U.S. men's team. So, and yesterday's performance was just fascinating to watch. I don't see how you can't be entertained by what Tim Howard did. You know, next to actually scoring a goal, all those goals, like being stopped, was just phenomenal.
So, Joseph, can we count on you to watch the next World Cup, or does it end here?
Or is it kind of dependent upon how the Team USA
does?
It's like I said yesterday, you know, I'm so upset that Team USA lost, but I'm not going to watch soccer for 4 years.
Okay.
Now I feel like hysteria.
How could you not? It's so exciting. I loved it.
Sarah, you watched it?
Yeah, well, okay. I was also on deadline, so the people in my newsroom also had it on, and I watched as much of it as I possibly could, but it was so heartbreaking, right? Like how, it's like when your goalie is that good, it's almost like
it is hard. It ends up
the way it does.
It is tough to watch, to see that, you know, so many attempts, and two are going to get past you. That's all you can expect, and you would hope that the rest of the team would pull their weight and tie it up at least to make it interesting. So, yeah, that is heartbreaking. You feel sorry for Tim Howard.
Oh, I don't feel sorry for him. Mad skills on display.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah, and people are now calling him, you know, like the best goalie possibly in World Cup history. I mean, it's amazing.
Go ahead, tell us, Joseph. It was a record. In 50 years, nobody has had more stops than Tim Howard did. 16 stops. So
I think we call them saves, but that's good. We'll get the lingo together.
Actually know.
And the field we call the pitch.
Right.
I'm just trying to keep you all up to straight.
Thank
okay.
You.
All right. So you're set up for next time. You're set up for next time. Maybe you're not quite ready for the face paint, but you're set up
exactly.
for the next time. All right. Well, switching gears a bit, you might have heard that R&B singer Robin Thicke and his wife, the actress Paula Patton, broke up, reportedly because of Thicke's infidelity, among other factors. And so you might be wondering, why is this any of our business? Well, the answer to that is that he's made it a public matter by making it the centerpiece of his latest album and music video. He named his new album Paula, and over the weekend he made another plea for forgiveness for whatever it was that he did during his performance at the BET Awards.
I'd like to dedicate this song to my wife and say I miss you and I'm sorry. And this is called Forever Love. I can't carry the weight around, baby. How can I have ever belonged? Learning all my lessons.
Well, you know, we don't know whether Paula Patton is buying any of this, but apparently fans and critics are not. I mean, earlier this week, he hosted a Twitter Q&A with VH1 to promote the new album. And let me just say, well, some of these tweets speak for themselves. Quote, how many naked women did it take before you stopped seeing them as people and instead saw them as YouTube hits? Hashtag ask Thicke. And why hasn't Paula filed a restraining order yet? She has plenty of evidence. Hashtag ask Thicke. So, Michael Arsenault, let me start with you on this. There's a long history of begging in R&B, right? Number one.
Yes.
And people putting their relationship business in their music. And I'm thinking about Pink's song about her separation from her husband called So What. He was even in the video. Of course, they later reconciled. But I was just wondering, why do you think people are so annoyed at this Robin Thicke move? Nobody seems to be finding this amusing.
You know, initially, I will say I thought it might have been a little bit overbearing, the criticism. Like maybe some people were kind of projecting their own things, but the more he opens his mouth, the more intense he's proven himself to be. So I don't think he's getting Paula back, but I look forward to like the Law and Order SVU episode that'll be inspired by this. But it's like, it would have been nice maybe if he had just limited to, I'm going to name the album Paula, I'm going to have some sad songs, I'm going to continue copying Marvin Gaye, and then what will happen will happen. But he literally, the video, the songs, the hashtags, the speeches, the Spotify list, like, dude, she gone.
Bridget, what about you?
Well, a lot of people have been calling him like a stalker. Like, they're like, this is kind of scary. And I wouldn't go that far, because Paula Patton hasn't really said anything about this. Even her Twitter profile still says, I'm the wife of the brilliant singer or whatever, Robin Thicke. So for all we know, she could have said something like, Robin, you need to prove to me that you love me. So I don't really know. But I will say that it kind of seems that if a big part of their breakup has to do with the fact that he put so much of their business out on the street. He cheated on her kind of publicly. He had the Miley Cyrus performance, which was really disrespectful. It doesn't seem like getting her back, the way to get her back is to put more of their business in the street, to make this video with these kind of mock text messages that are supposed to be like conversations they had. And one of them says, you embarrassed me. So like, if this isn't embarrassing, I don't know what is. Like, it's everywhere.
Interesting. Joseph Cummins, what do you think?
I think that the pushback that he's getting, look, he deserves all the jokes, all the ridicule, because of the fact that that's what happens when you make yourself vulnerable in the public eye. But I also don't want us to discourage artists from being honest about what they're going through and putting that on record. And I think that when we shame him for opening up the way that he has, it doesn't give artists any reason to open up about what's going on in their lives. Because, you know, you think that what could Robin have done, considering that in real life we knew that he was going through a messy separation? He could have followed up and made Blurred Lines 2, the kind of album that put him that many say put him in hot water in the first place, and we would have all known that he would have been faking. We probably wouldn't have bought into it. We probably wouldn't have cared to listen as closely as we are listening to Paula. As an album, I personally don't like it. I gave it a couple of spins yesterday, and it was hard to get through. But for the most part, I have to commend him for not being afraid, knowing that you're going to get it. Everybody is going to take you through the ringer for doing this, but I can admire him. And the other thing is, I just think that one thing that gets lost is context. He's been with her for 20 years, and that's his wife. That's not, and I just feel like you can, for your wife, you can go that you can try as hard as possible. You owe it to yourself. You owe it to that many years of being together. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. At least you tried.
Get your bag on. That's right. Go ahead. Sarah, are you? Was that a cry of pain there? I wasn't sure.
That wasn't me, but okay.
That was me.
That was you, Michael. That was me. All right, Sarah, what do you think?
I feel that cry of pain. It is just, I feel like it's gotten to the point where it's creepy. Like, it is awkward to watch. That video with the bloody nose, with all the little speech bubbles coming up, talking about how, you know, she's saying he did, you know, why are you doing me like this? I don't know. The whole thing is just so weird. It's so creepy. I don't understand why he's made it such a public thing when it's such a private thing. And it's really hard to take him seriously. Like, I feel like he's almost trying to make it out like he's the victim. And I feel like, given his track record for the way that he treats women, it's pretty hard to take that seriously.
For people who don't remember the Blurred Lines, part of the controversy about Blurred Lines is that you had three men in the video. He was one of them, Pharrell Williams being being one, and the third being
Pharrell. Pharrell, T.I.
And T.I. Yeah. But the men were all clothed, and there were two versions. In one, the women were fully naked, and one they were kind of halfway naked or mostly naked. And so there was that kind of power dynamic, which is like, why do you have three married men walk fully clothed and then these naked women prancing around them, which is something that pushed a lot of people's buttons and people did not appreciate, and which he defended throughout the summer. So is part of the difference, like with Pink, Sarah, let me just ask you this really briefly before we move on. Do you think it's because this feels, because Pink's song and video were funny and kind of, and seem to be kind of two ways, like we're both wrong and I'm crazy too, or is it because you think he's a man and people aren't want to hear that from
no,
a man?
No, because to me, the Blurred Lines video was actually one of the lesser problems with Blurred Lines. Mm-hmm. I feel like Blurred Lines at minimum was disrespectful to women. I think almost everyone agrees on that. And I feel like at maximum, it condoned rape. And so I don't feel like I take him seriously as someone who has a lot of respect for women, who takes them seriously, who in this new video that he released, it echoes ideas about domestic violence and domestic abuse, which I feel like are not things that we should be taking very lightly. So I just don't see him as the victim in all of this. And I appreciate the idea that we need to encourage artists to be sincere about what they're saying, but I also just feel like he is not going about it in a way that's conducive to getting her back or even seeming like a rational human being.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the week's pop culture news. We're speaking with producer Sarah Ventry and Bridget Armstrong and writers Joseph Cummings and Michael Arsenault. So let's stay on the BET Awards and talk about another artist who made waves. Rapper Nicki Minaj won the award for Best Female Hip-Hop Artist. That's a category she's won for the past 5 years. No surprise there. But during her acceptance speech, it seems like she was throwing some shade at another rapper nominated in the category. And we're talking about Iggy Azalea. Let's hear a clip.
What I want the world to know about Nicki Minaj is when you hear Nicki Minaj spit, Nicki Minaj wrote it. I'ma do me, and I hope and pray that BET continues to honor authenticity. And that's all I'ma say about that.
And what she was saying about that was Iggy Azalea is a white Australian rising star. Forbes even did a profile of her with the headline, Hip Hop is Run by a White Blonde Australian Woman. And even though there was some backlash, the headline was changed to Hip Hop's Unlikely New Star, a White Blonde Australian Woman. But you know, Sarah, Sarah Ventry, I'm going to go to you on this because you're a hip hop fan and you've also kind of navigated this whole question before of who's got the right to the spotlight and so forth. What do you make of this? Sarah? So we have lost Sarah. So then, Michael, I'm going to go to you. What do you think?
Hashtag Team Minaj. I actually did not have a problem. I love what Nicki said. And it's interesting because Iggy did an interview with The Guardian, and she said of the criticism about her with the fake accent and kind of appropriating the culture that, well, none of my peers say anything, only like music critics. Well, finally, one of your peers is actually saying something. My issue with Iggy Azalea isn't so much that she exists per se, because I think eventually we were going to have a white female rapper be successful, and that's perfectly fine. I'm annoyed by her because she's basically Charlie Baltimore rapping like Diamond from Crime Mob, and she has no real association with the culture.
Tell him, Michael.
And,
tell him, Michael.
You know, my issue with people like her and Miley Cyrus is when people of that culture that you're dipping your toe in tell you, you know, that we have an issue with you because of this, and you're dismissive and disingenuous and very, like, nasty at what you're told, it only makes you more irritated. And I think for Nicki, because I know a lot of people have criticized Nicki for wanting to cross over and being so blatant about it, so in some respects, who is she to question authenticity? But at the same time, as a female rapper, it has to be very hard for her to get that sort of airplay. Like, she had a sizable fan base before she really blew up, but it wasn't until Taylor Swift and Selena Gomez co-signed Superbass that she really became the Nicki Minaj that she is now.
Oh, okay.
Where somebody like Iggy can do Fancy and just kind of skate on by.
But is that her issue, or is that the market issue? That's the question I have.
It's not her fault, but If you get to, if you have privilege, then you should be able to deal with the little bit of pushback that you get back.
Let's hear from some of the women on this too. Okay.
Well, it's not necessarily her issue. It's the fact that she appeals to not necessarily a wider audience, but a different audience. And so, in the same way that Macklemore can kind of appeal to parents of like suburban white kids, they feel fine with their children listening to this music. Iggy Azalea appeals to people who kind of think, you know, it's a novelty, or people who are into hip hop but don't see themselves reflected as the kind of traditional hip hop base. They're not the young black kind of urban.
Why is that different from a black classical artist, though, or a black an artist in a genre that is not traditionally considered black? What's wrong? What's so terrible?
It's not that it's different, but I think what happens is if you have a black traditional artist or another genre, people who are kind of a part of that community co-sign them too. They say, you know, oh, this person's a great musician. This person's and with the Macklemore and the Iggy Azalea, there's a lot of people in the hip hop community who do not co-sign either one of them.
Sarah Ventry, you're back with us. Let's hear from you.
So I actually do think it's a little bit different than having a black artist in the classical world for two reasons. I feel like one is that when a white person is entering the hip-hop world, white privilege is working for them in the hip-hop world as in life. So I feel like a black person going into the classical world does not have any sort of additional privilege that they're taking with them. And I also feel like there's the question of co-optation, which I don't think comes up in the classical world, and I don't think it comes up the same way as when a white artist is trying to make what is traditionally considered black music.
Okay, thumbs up. We only have 6 seconds left, so thumbs up or thumbs down on Iggy Azalea, Sarah.
Sideways.
Okay. Tristan, I'm sorry. We don't have time for you on this. So we'll apologize. Next time we'll get to you on this. That was Sarah Ventry. She's a senior producer at member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Sorry for the technical problem there, Sarah. We'll do better by you next time. Michael Arsenault is a writer and contributor to Complex.com. Joseph Cummings is the creator of the blog Until I Get Married. Michael and Joseph were with us from our bureau in New York. Bridget Armstrong is a Tell Me More producer and the creator of the blog BiggerPicture.com. She was with us in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, for decades, many gay and lesbian Americans felt they had to keep their relationship secret. Now a new project is giving them a voice.
And then we kissed. It was the most romantic time in my life. It was like something from a movie.
We'll hear from 70-year-old Patty Woods. She's part of the StoryCorps Project's new Out Loud series. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems. At pewtrusts.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts since 1985, cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's been 38 years since the Supreme Court reinstituted the death penalty, and Professor Robert Blecker says it's necessary for some crimes.
The sadistic killers, mass murderers, terrorists, there's a group that we can clearly identify.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Tune in to WILL-TV and celebrate Independence Day with A Capital Fourth. Hosted by Tom Bergeron, the program features a patriotic evening of musical performances by some of the country's best-known musicians, along with the National Symphony Orchestra. Broadcast live from the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol, A Capital Fourth also presents the most spectacular fireworks display anywhere in the nation. Watch A Capital Fourth, Friday night at 7 on WILL-TV.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Our next guest is one of Hollywood's quiet superstars. Don Cheadle first made a name for himself in high-impact supporting roles, but then Hotel Rwanda earned him stardom and an Oscar nomination for playing the real-life hotel manager who protected more than 1,000 Tutsis from the Hutu militia during the Rwandan Civil War. Since then, he's made his mark with a very different role as the too-slick-by-half but very layered character of Marty Kahn in Showtime's House of Lies. That role has earned him 2 Emmy nominations, and he's also known in Hollywood as a man with a deep interest in human rights. Now he's involved in another labor of love. He's launched a crowdfunding campaign to raise money for a Miles Davis biopic titled Miles Ahead.
Miles Davis was not a typical jazz musician. In fact, that's a word that he really didn't care for. He thought the word jazz was too limiting to really express the breadth and scope of what he did. He preferred that his work be referred to as social music, the music of its time. And in keeping with that spirit, I think it's only befitting that the making of this movie be a social experience.
Cheadle plans to co-write, direct, and star in the film. And when we heard this news, we thought this would be a good opportunity to revisit a conversation I had with him last year as part of our Wisdom Watch series. And I started by asking him how he got interested in acting to begin with.
I was told by relatives, you know, aunts and uncles, that, you know, I remember going home for a funeral of one of my cousins that I really didn't know very well. And someone came up to me and said, "Hey, you did it." And I was like, "I did it." She goes, "Yeah, you used to say when you were 5, 6 years old running around here that you wanted to be an actor." I said, "I did." She's like, "Yeah, you used to say that." So I guess it was something that was in my mind very early. I know that I got very serious about it once I graduated from high school. I had a few choices to either pursue acting or to pursue music. And I think I really looked at what it would take to really commit to being a musician, the work and the kind of commitment to that, and realized that I was not ready for that.
I understand, though, that you got your first paid acting jobs while you were still in drama school, right?
Yeah.
And you've been working pretty steadily since the 1980s. Do you feel like you've made it now?
What we all know in this business is that you don't really retire from it. It sort of retires you. It usually happens for people when they hadn't anticipated it, so I don't think it's going to be any different from me. I feel very fortunate and blessed to be a part of projects that have meant a lot to me, and that people have seemed to, it seems to, you know, hold a special place for people. But I don't ever sit back and think that I can just chill out and that I don't have any more work to do. I always feel like I'm grinding. I always feel like I'm trying to make sure that I am continuing to push in and push myself into new places and be as elastic as I can as an actor.
So what do you think is the major factor in your not only your consistently being able to work, but the wide range of things you've been able to do?
Well, look, you know, the only power that we have as actors in this business, I mean, unless somehow you're financing the piece that you're a part of and putting it together yourself, we just have the power of no. So it's not that I haven't been offered roles that were just like the last thing I did. I just said I don't want to do it. I just said no. I was always picky. I was very fortunate because the timing was always such that right when things would be getting kind of threadbare and it was like, dang, I hope something happens, something would happen. And I'd be fortunate enough to, that something was something that I wanted to be a part of and was able to, no necessarily effort of my own, able to be a part of a project that went. Because I've been, you know, I've been on sets before, you know, the first day of Hotel Rwanda, in fact, we were in Africa, we were at lunch. My agent called and said, "How's it going?" I said, "It's all right." He said, "Hey, I just want to tell you that there's no money in escrow for this movie." I said, "What?" He goes, "You're there for free. No money has been sent to the bank. So we can send you a ticket and you can come home, or you can stay there and hope everything works out." I'm like, I guess I'm going to stick it out.
Why did you stick it out with Hotel Rwanda? I think, I'm not sure everybody remembers the backstory there. It took 5 years to make. As you mentioned, there were financial challenges, weather problems, all sorts of, you know, drama, you know, and getting it done. I was wondering, first of all, why you decided to stick it out, and secondly, what did it mean to you when it finally did come out?
Well, it's one of those movies that, you know, I read the script and I had, you know, started doing the research on the materials, and I'd seen a Frontline piece on it, which was really arresting and haunting and deep. And Paul Rusesabagina, who I played in the movie, was in the Frontline piece. I had his number and I called him and we spoke for a long time. And I just felt that it was a movie. When I met with Terry, who directed the movie, he said, I got to be honest with you, if Will Smith says yes or Cuba Gooding Jr. says yes to this part, it's theirs, because I've been trying to get this movie made for years and years, and I'm going to make it with whoever I need to make it with. And I said, I fully understand that. And in fact, if I can get it to them and help you get this movie made as a producer, I would love to do that, because I think the story needs to be told. I felt that strongly about the story. A lot of the extras in the film had lived through the genocide, and it was just all around us. And I really believed in the project.
Is that what then motivated you to get involved in Darfur? We were speaking earlier and mentioned that we had talked before about a book that you co-wrote, bringing attention to the human crisis in Darfur, and something you had been working on for really quite a long time. You've done quite a lot in this area of fundraising, not just fundraising and not just lending your name kind of passively, but really organizing events and putting your shoulder to the wheel. Did it start with Hotel Rwanda, or was that something that you had been interested in before that?
It did. I was... there were several screenings around town, and there was an MGM screening that Ed Royce attended, who was a congressman from Orange County, California. And he and Donald Payne sat on the African Affairs Committee, and they were trying to raise awareness about what was happening in Darfur. And it was sort of falling on deaf ears. And they believed that there were a lot of illusions in Hotel Rwanda. And he got in touch with me and said, you know, we're going on a congressional delegation to the area to speak with some leaders there, to try and talk to the government, to tour the area with the African Union. And would you like to attend? And I said, of course. So that just sort of started the momentum and the ball rolling. And that's what Not On Our Watch came out of, both the book and the organization. And I went there again with George Clooney, and we went to China and we went to Egypt to try and speak to the leadership there to exert their influence. So it was something that, you know, like you say, was inspired by the film and my involvement with that, but sort of took on a life of its own afterwards.
Do you feel satisfied with your efforts? Do you feel you made a difference?
And I wouldn't use the word satisfied. I feel like sometimes a situation of two steps forward and three steps back, you know, right now the violence is not as bad as it's ever been, because many of those villages and those people are gone, or they're living on the outskirts in Chad and the mountains around the area. So they're not there anymore. But we still have the Janjaweed there. There's still government-sanctioned attacks that are happening for the people there, because the international community has not done anything to prevent it. The North-South conflict was something that was much more pressing for people, and that would have rightfully, I think it needed the attention, because that would have, had that blown into a full-blown civil war, it would have been tens of millions of people killed, potentially. So that did deserve the attention, but then Darfur becomes a stepchild, and people aren't focusing on that, and so that was sort of allowed to go unchecked. We were able to, with Not On Our Watch, start the Sentinel program with the Enough Project. So there is a satellite that we rented time on that watches, you know, the amassing of troops and where these graves are buried, and is collecting data if there is ever a trial at The Hague where Bashir or Haroon or any of the leadership are brought to face the charges. There's a lot of evidence that's been stockpiled and it's been compiled. But at the same time, unless there's an international effort to bring them to The Hague and make them answer for these charges, we're going to be in a very similar situation. So I wouldn't say that I'm satisfied. I think there has been progress that's made. But until there's been justice, I will continue to be dissatisfied, and will continue to bang the drum.
We call these conversations Wisdom Watch, where we ask people to reflect, and maybe, you know, people who are at a point in their life where they can reflect, you know, and sort of think back. Is there any wisdom you'd pass on perhaps to somebody just starting out, or somebody listening to our conversation who would like to do what you do?
You know, people come up to me and they ask me what can they do to get started all of the time. And I really feel like it's such a letdown, because it's hard for me to give advice, because I started, you know, almost 27, 28 years ago now. And the business has changed so much. You look at television nowadays and you see guest stars that have had film careers, or like me, leads in television shows that, you know, are film actors. And those parts used to be able to go to people who were quote unquote unknown. So I don't know anymore where you start. The great thing is now, however, people, if, you know, they really get serious about their craft and work hard and bring their unique voices and interesting perspectives on stories, there's places where you can sell. So you don't have to knock on the door of a lot of these networks and try to get a gig. You can create your own opportunity and just put it out, you know, yourself and find people that will buy it and then kind of build that infrastructure around you and help you to really realize your full vision. Mm-hmm. So I always encourage people to, if they want to really work on getting into this business, to be writers first. Don't worry about being an actor first. Be a writer. Create something. Own it. And then you know, the world is yours. You can really dictate the terms of how that will happen. And that's only going to happen because unique, creative, interesting voices and stories are coming up. You know, don't try to run down the same lane that people have done before. You know, you've create your own lane. And that's the opportunity that is there now that actually wasn't there when I was, you know, just coming out.
You have a very successful family life as well. And that's something that people don't always associate with Hollywood. And so, well, not just Hollywood, but let's just be honest about it. It seems like family is under a lot of stress in this country right now.
No, it's real.
You know?
That's true.
So
yeah.
I wanted to ask, do you have any advice to offer just about having a full life?
Don't be afraid of work. I think a lot of times people are predisposed to believe that adversity means it's not going to work and this is too hard and it shouldn't work and it's too difficult. I'm very lucky that the person that I was with was down to travel with me. And when I did Hotel Rwanda, I put my kids in school out there and they were in school and I was working and she had to figure out what to do with her days. Now, she's industrious and smart and so she did that. But had she not wanted to play ball, that would have been really a tough one. And we went through a lot of work together. We had couples therapy. We had family therapy. We knew that we didn't have the tools to do it all by ourselves. And so we went and got tools. So that's something that is available that not everybody does, that I recommend that they do if they're really serious about trying to work that stuff out, because it ain't easy. You know, there's you, there's her, or you and him, or her and her, him, whatever, you guys as individuals. And then that third entity, which is the two of you, that union is not either one of you. And that thing has its own rules. So that's a lot of work to figure that thing out. And you bring kids into it. I can understand why people don't quote unquote make it, but if you do, the rewards are amazing, and it's worth it.
Don Cheadle, actor, activist, family man. He spoke with us from NPR West in Culver City, California, last September. Finally, we'd like to take a moment to remember the 1969 Stonewall Riots. It's been 45 years since gay protesters clashed with police in New York City. The event is considered the beginning of the LGBT civil rights movement. It's an event that StoryCorps wants to commemorate. Now, StoryCorps is the group that records interviews between loved ones and archives them at the Library of Congress. Their new initiative called Out Loud records and amplifies the voices of the LGBTQ community, including members of the pre-Stonewall generation. That's people like 70-year-old Patty Woods, who recorded an interview in San Francisco with 22-year-old Cedar Lay. Patty Woods looked back to the 1970s when she met a woman who would become her life partner and leave a long-lasting mark on her life.
I was working in a restaurant, and she would come every day for lunch. I was like, oh my God, I want to know her. And I just insisted on finding ways to get together with her. And one night we went out to dinner and we came back to my house and we were having some cocktails. And I said, I just want to tell you something. After that, if you want to leave, I understand. I proceeded to tell her that I was lesbian and that I was interested in her and more than just a friend. There was music going on, and she stood up, and I thought, well, she's leaving. And she grabbed me, and she started to dance. And then we kissed. It was the most romantic time in my life. It was like something from a movie. And that was my first kiss. We had very strong feelings for each other, but both of us were closeted. I would introduce her as my best friend. When she got cancer, I said I just wouldn't want to live if anything happened to her. I never felt that feeling about anybody. It was the most difficult time of my life. I took care of her, and people thought I was such a good friend. She wanted to tell her family, my family, but we both felt nobody would understand. If they accepted us as being close friends and we could continue to spend the time together, we still were better off than threatening that private time. And when she eventually died, I had to pretend I was grieving my best friend, and I never really could openly let people know what a loss I had. She was more than my best friend. I feel she was my soulmate.
That's Patti Woods remembering her partner, who died in 1988. The interview is part of StoryCorps' Out Loud, recording the stories of the LGBTQ community. If there's someone you would like to interview or add your own story to the Library of Congress, visit StoryCorps.org. To hear more StoryCorps on their podcast, it's on iTunes and NPR.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.